I'm going to start today with a reading from a book called The Book of Qualities by J. Ruth Gendler. Grief. Before she came to this town, Grief was a woman named Aaliyah. She was a potter, and she glazed her big-bellied pots with earth colors until they shone like a dull bronze. She had four children. The daughters lived inland now in the distant foothills, and the oldest son left the family as soon as he could get away. It was the young boy with the golden curls and the laughing eyes who gave her great joy. He loved the ocean. He was barely walking when he learned to swim, and not much older when he started to sail. One day, about 2 years ago, the sailors brought his boat home empty. Never had I heard such sounds of weeping as when Grief found out her son had drowned. She screamed and howled. She stamped her feet and smashed her pots and bowls. She ate with all her fingers. She tore at her hair, and it grew wild and matted. She wandered from place to place with no sense of where she was or how she came there. One day, at the edge of the forest, Grief heard another woman crying out. She spoke with her. She listened to her story. Grief was surprised. She had never met anyone else who had suffered as she had. Together, the women sat in the clearing and mourned their children. Through the long afternoon, through the twilight, through the night, they wept and wept and wept and wept. In the morning, Grief was washed clean of her tears. She came to our town and started to do her real work. Many years ago, I read a book by the author Kevin Brockmeyer called The Brief History of the Dead. The premise of the book is based on Eastern Africans, specifically Kenyan and other countries that speak Swahili, their ways of talking about dimensions of space and time. It is a way to understand where our spirits go after we die. Brockmeyer quotes from James Lowen's Lies My Teacher Told Me at the beginning of the book, quote, "Humans can be divided into three categories, those that are still alive on Earth, the recently departed, or the Sasha in Swahili, and the dead, the Zamani. And when people die, they are Sasha, while people are still alive who remember them. When the last person remembering them dies, they go to the Zamani and are then revered and recalled by name only," end quote. I would say that they become our ancestors who we revere and look to for guidance as we navigate our lives. Prophets, mystics, and countless philosophers have put forth ideas, beliefs, and theories for what happens when we die. The only truth we know for certain that applies to every single human being who ever existed are two. We are born and we die. We know what happens after we are born, some sort of living in some sort of place with various events that take place throughout our lives. What we don't know is what happens when any of us die, when we are not here anymore. We learn about the finality of death at different ages. We may learn about it when we are 4 years old and a beloved pet dies, or when we are teenagers and a grandparent dies, or when we are adults and we have to bid farewell to parents, partners, friends, and yet more of our beloved pets. It is when a loved one dies that our heart constricts and we may cry and we may sit with others who share that love and tell stories about our beloved. By the time I was 13 years old, I had lost two members of my nuclear family. My sister died at 1 month old when I was four. And when I was 13, my father, Asayid, died at the age of 42. We knew it would happen. He was ill. And we knew that his illness was terminal. I can't say we were prepared because I'm not sure that we can truly be prepared for someone who has become a part of us to one day be here breathing with a heartbeat and the next day gone with what made them alive no longer inhabiting their bodies. Nothing can truly prepare us for that loss. When my father died, my younger sister and I had been living full-time with our mother, as our parents had divorced 5 years earlier. My memories of my father were full of fun and visits to museums, and twice we went to the New Jersey shore and to the town of Wildwood, where there were boardwalks and carnival games and rides. There were some painful memories, too, but they didn't seem as important for me to hold on to. What I wanted to hold tight to my chest was his sense of humor, his joy, and his determination to live life to its fullest. As for processing the death of my father, I would be sad at times, sure, but I didn't really feel devastated about his loss until much later in my life. When I finally identified the black hole that I was living with that I didn't even realize was there, that hole was once my father's life. Twice in my life it hit me the hardest. The first was when I was in my mid-20s, and my father at that point had been gone at least 10 years, and I remember being around a friend's father and suddenly becoming overwhelmed with emotion. I ran into a restroom and just cried. I remember saying to a close friend afterwards, my friend Brother Rob, who's a Catholic Marist brother, "I don't understand. I thought I was over my father's death." And he looked at me and said, "Aisha, we don't ever get over the death of a loved one. The best we can do is to work through it at different times in our lives when we need to." The second time it hit me the hardest and one of the saddest days of my life was when I was in my mid-30s, and the day that I realized I wasn't remembering the stories of the times with my father that my father and I shared together. I wasn't remembering the smell of his aftershave. My father wore Old Spice, and for at least 10 years after he died, when I would walk by someone with that scent, I would immediately smile and think of him. When I realized I no longer had these memories readily available, I felt a deep well of sadness overwhelm me. I shared with a friend how I was feeling, and they suggested I talk to my Aunt Erica. She was married to my father's brother, and they suggested I ask her to share the stories she remembered to help me hold on to his memories. I still find myself talking to her often about my father to hold on to those memories of him as long as possible. I do have a picture of him on the table holding me when I was 3 years old. As Unitarian Universalists, we're good at memorials and celebrations of life. I once heard a UU minister say that as soon as someone dies, we go right back to our Protestant roots. We make a casserole and bring it over to the family. I think we, not only UUs, but as those in the United States are heavily influenced by our Protestant forebears. People in this society struggle with the negative feelings of death and mourning, and we immediately want to bury the person and move on. I look at the cultures where the mourning process is not rushed. In the Jewish tradition, the family of the deceased sits Shiva, a 7-day mourning period. The Muslim mourning period is 3 days and up to 40 days for a widow or widower. I learned from the former East Shore member who served as a Chinook councilwoman, Kate Elliott, that in the Chinook tradition, the name of the deceased is not spoken aloud for an entire year. What does it mean for us to sit with sadness and grief, and why is our culture so afraid of these feelings? Of course, it is hard and painful, as it should be. I took a parenting class once when my children were younger, where our instructor told us the importance of letting our children sit with negative feelings, whether they be disappointment, anger, and yes, even sadness. It is only by experiencing the negativity that we learn to work through it and strengthen our resiliency muscle. It's God calling. No, it is not easy, but feeling pain is part of what it means to be human. Working through that pain in community and with the care and connection of others is also what it means to be human. Strong connections are impactful and run deep. Parental connections are sometimes the deepest. A friend and colleague, the Reverend Danielle DeBona, served as a hospice chaplain, and for 16 years she experienced sitting with people who are dying and their families. When asked to share some of what she learned, she said that one of the things she noticed was that mothers are reluctant to die in the presence of their children. I know that is true in our family. My mother-in-law did not die until her son, my husband, left her side after he had sat with her for hours. And in the 45 minutes between his leaving and her partner showing up, she had passed away. Part of the meaning-making of grief and processing loss is that we start to find new ways to connect with the person who has died. Often we start thinking about the person at their best and what we will miss the most. Our faith community does its very best to be the container for those who are grieving. We gather for memorial services and provide comfort and solace to the families of those whose lives we lost. We tell stories and share memories of the people who were part of the East Shore family. I'm thinking of Susan Marston, Dick Jackie, Paul Fussell, Doris Berg, and Earl Fleahart, to name a few of the people who have passed away and whose lives touched mine here at East Shore. I carry my stories of connections with them in my heart. One of my favorite stories about Earl Fleahart was one day about 2 or 3 years ago, he walked into my office in the middle of the week and kind of gruffly and nicely said, Aisha, I just want to let you know I noticed that there's more children and I like that and you're doing a good job. And I just said, thank you so much, Earl. I wrapped my arms around him and he patted me awkwardly and didn't know quite what to do with my enthusiastic appreciation. But it was very sweet. It was sweet because he didn't have to do that. But he did. He was a very, very kind man. East Shore can be a place of solace and comfort for those in need in many different capacities. We have teams of people whose ministry is to support everyone in this community when comfort is needed. For example, the pastoral care team led by Millie Malarkey will visit in your home and call and be there when you need them. The Helping Hands team, organized by Carol Sinapi, will bring food and coordinate rides when needed. And of course, our senior minister, Reverend Dr. Steve Furr, is always available for a visit or a phone call, except in the month of November when he's in Australia. And then it's Reverend Jim Vanderweel. I want to leave you with some of my memories of my father, Sayyid Mahmoud Qadar. He had a zest for life and adventure. In the 60s, he lived in Russia, where he met and married his first wife, Nina. In the 70s, he immigrated to New York City and became a New York City cab driver until he could get a job for what he was trained for as a marine architect. He was part of the group of men who founded the first mosque in New Jersey City, New Jersey, in the mid-70s. When I told that memory to a friend at Unitarian Universalist General Assembly a few years ago, she said, oh, well, that's where you get your religious leadership inspiration. It had never occurred to me until she said that. He had a wonderful sense of humor and was an extrovert who had many friends and loved a good party. I thank him for coming to the United States, where he knew his daughters would have opportunities they would not have been afforded in Egypt. I live the life I lead thanks to him. Allah yarhamak ya Aba, which is Arabic for may God bless you. May we continue to share our stories of those we loved and lost and strengthen our connections to those living with us now. Amen, Ashe, and blessed be.